Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Paul Clark, a member of the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today's program, Women in National Security. In the U.S., in the last few decades, women have come to their own on taking on leadership roles in national security. Three of the last five secretaries of state have been women, as have two of the last three U.N. ambassadors. And it's not just in diplomacy, it's in all realms that deal with national security. Women were on the short list for leadership at the Secretary of Defense recent nomination, at the FBI recent nomination, the CIA director recent nominations. Dozens of women serve as general officers in uniform. And we also seem to have something approaching a parity between the genders on the National Security Council staff and the staff on congressional houses. It's a sea change in the last 30 or so years. So why is this happening? And who are these women who are crafting our foreign policy and our defense policy? What viewpoints are they bringing? What changes have been wrought to international security, national security? And what new ideas are we seeing that show up? For example, ideas about human security. Well, I could go on and talk about it for an hour, but instead we've did something much smarter. And we have two really talented speakers who we'd like you to listen to for a while and then ask questions of, because they have some great insights, but I'm sure you have some great questions too. So our first speaker is Anya Manuel, co-founder and partner at Rice Hadley Gates, LLC, and lecturer at Stanford University. From 2005 to 2007, she served as a special assistant to Undersecretary for Political Affairs Nicholas Burns, at the U.S. State Department. Ms. Manuel was part of the negotiating team for the U.S.-India Civilian Nuclear Accord and was very much involved in U.S. foreign policy and defense policy towards Afghanistan and Pakistan, some mighty weighty issues indeed. So without any further ado, Ms. Manuel, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having us and for addressing such an important topic. I'm going to keep my formal comments brief because I think there are a lot of senior and distinguished folks, especially women in the audience, and I want to make this an informal session and a real interchange. But let me start with two issues. One, why are we talking about this topic at all? Why is it important to have women in national security? And then secondly, I'll just run you a little bit through the boring statistics to see where we are compared to especially other occupations where women are now starting to make headway. So first, why are we even talking about this topic? When Lauren and I first thought about giving this talk, we had a brief call, and I actually went out and looked for studies on whether women perform differently in national security roles than men do. Not surprisingly, I wasn't able to find any academic subjects on studies on this topic because this is a pretty new phenomenon. But there are a lot of studies in the corporate world done by Catalyst and other organizations that find very clear evidence that where you have a larger number of women, and the magic number seems to be around 30%, in senior positions in a corporation or on the board of a corporation, that company has significantly better financial results and return on equity. Pretty clear stats. So there's no reason that having a diversity of viewpoints in national security shouldn't also improve that apparatus. And I saw this firsthand in a really particular way, especially I was a diplomat, but seeing the military in Afghanistan and seeing areas where you're dealing with conservative societies, you're dealing with Muslim women, and the difference it made to have female soldiers go in on night raids, walking through villages, both in terms of making the population feel more comfortable and in terms of, in some cases, creating a role model for some of these young girls and older women that they were interacting with. So I think it's fair to say that we're convinced that it's important to have women in these roles, and they are showing up in increasing numbers. But let me talk you through a little bit where we are. Most of these statistics come from a recent Women in International Security report, and they're pretty hard to come by, but they've dug them up. So women in the federal workforce overall, pretty high, and has been for a long time. It was around 41% in the mid-1980s, and it's around 44% now. Now, that's overall. When you get to the senior levels, the numbers drop pretty drastically. So what in government parlance is called the senior executive service, which is the career folks, not the people who are coming in as political appointees. Throughout the government agencies, you see a massive drop of women, so the pyramid doesn't move its way all the way up. At state, the numbers are pretty good. Most recently, you had 33% women in the senior executive service. At USAID, you have 29%. At the Department of Defense, in the civilian side, you have 22%. And in Homeland Security, you have around 26%. So they're there. They're present. It's not nothing, but it's definitely not approaching 50. In the military, the story is similar, although it's a bit more depressing, frankly. The active duty enlisted women and officers has stayed roughly flat. It was 13% in 1995, and in 2011 it was a whopping 14.6%. We're not going anywhere. We're very quickly. In the reserves, it's slightly higher, closer to 20%, and the Air Force seems to be the most progressive service with almost 20% active duty women, so much higher. And in the higher ranks, even though Paul was right to say that there are dozens of generals and admirals that are women, I think the statistics are still pretty dismal. 69 of the 976 generals and admirals are women, 7.1%. So we're not quite there yet in the uniformed military. Now, I've run you through these boring statistics. They're not actually that great. They're improving a little bit, but the slope is shallow, not steep. But I just wanted to compare it a little bit to what's happening in other professions that have traditionally been male-dominated. So when I looked those up, even though more than 50% of university graduates are women, 47% of law school graduates, women still only make up 19% of partners at law firms, 16% of senior managers at investment banks, and about 14% of senior executives in the Fortune 500. So what you're seeing in the government is actually a little bit better than what you're seeing in the United States in other pretty demanding occupations. So how do we promote more women? And I think we'll talk about this in greater detail. I think it's no different in the government than it is in other occupations. Lauren and I talked about the importance of mentorship, and this is not, I was very lucky to have two very senior women mentors when I was a young student. One was Condoleezza Rice, the other was Anne-Marie Slaughter. Very, very lucky to have women who are actively pulling women up behind them. And I try to make it a point now when I teach at Stanford, I do a lot of sessions kind of like this with my female students to try to get them, encourage them to go in and keep at it. And so mentorship, I think, is the most important. And you need a real commitment by senior leaders that's more than lip service. I know Lauren will talk a little bit, I think, about the sexual assault issue. But there's a massive, a dramatic change in the military that happened in January of this year, which is that the military stopped excluding women from most combat roles. That is going to be a sea change. But what's interesting is when I was spending a lot of time in Afghanistan and Pakistan and interacting with our military there, you see a lot of women in roles that looked a lot like combat roles to me as a diplomat. So you'll see them sitting on a machine gun turret. We had women going in on raids, as I said, with our special forces teams. And they're there. They're getting killed in combat. It hasn't been, sometimes the positions aren't formally combat roles, but now there's going to be 4 years of study by all the armed services, including the special ops forces, the Navy SEALs, the Army Rangers, to see how to create standards that are gender neutral and that don't lower the standards for women, but gender neutral standards that would permit women to participate even in the most active duty of active duty roles. So I'll leave it there, and let Lauren say a few words, and then we'll open it up.
Well, great, thank you. Let me introduce Lauren Webster. Lauren Webster, since we're talking about the military, was commissioned in 2008 in the U.S. Navy as an intelligence officer. She served in with the Commander Pacific Fleet for 3 years, and she continues to serve in a reserve role with the Fleet Forces Command, the 10th Fleet, which does cyber operations. Mm-hmm. If you look under Wikipedia. which I should know since I teach at the Naval War College, but what the heck. Ms. Webster is also a director with the Chertoff Group right here in San Francisco. Many of you may not know about the national security organizations that operate in San Francisco and the Bay Area, but both these women have been associated with them to some degree. But the Chertoff Group does a wide range of security and strategic advisory services, and the function that Lauren performs, she supports companies that do cybersecurity and intelligence operations, which is great because that's your background. And now we'd like you to have a few minutes for the floor and have at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you all for being here. This is an important issue, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share some of my views and, more importantly, hear some of your questions and views as well. Like Anya, I'll try to keep it brief and open it up to the Q&A. There's really three things that I want to touch on before we go to the Q&A, and that is touching a bit more on the progress that has been made, but the gaps that remain, and particularly in the intelligence community and the defense world, and then focusing a bit more on observations on women's representation in cybersecurity, and then discussing a bit more on why this all matters. So why should we care about women's representation in national security decision-making roles? But before I get into that, I just wanted to share a personal story on sort of my aha moment of this is an important issue, and certainly interest in your perspectives on the aha moment for you. But nearly 20 years ago, my family and I spent a summer in Munich, Germany, where my parents were conducting research at the Max Planck Institute, and my younger sister and I were essentially free to roam the city and take in the great culture there. And a young woman, actually a Bay Area native, who was over there as part of her study at the School of Foreign Service, helped shepherd us around the city and show us some of the sites. And during that summer, we got to know her really well, and she confided in us one day. She said, you know, my goal, I want to be the first Secretary of State. And not long after, Bill Clinton appointed Madeleine Albright as the 64th Secretary of State. And that's when I realized, at the time she said that, I just went about eating my Bavarian pretzel and didn't really pay attention to it. But when that appointment happened, I realized that that her ambition had an importance and that she really recognized that that was something she should and could strive to achieve, and that it's important for women to be part of the national security community. So since then, I've tried to follow in her footsteps and do my part in service as well. But getting to the three points, as Paul and Anya have both noted, we're certainly making progress. In the defense and intelligence community specifically, we've had a number of firsts over the past 5 or so years. In 2008, General Ann Dunwoody became the first woman to put on her fourth star, a big accomplishment for women in military service. In 2010, Director Trish Long became the first woman to head a major intelligence agency when she was appointed head of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And just this year, we're expected to have the first female deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Interestingly, the CIA has historically led the intelligence community in employing women. I suspect it has something to do with women making better spies, but I've also been watching a lot of Homeland lately. So while these firsts are something to be celebrated, there's still significant progress to be made for women to achieve full representation. So we celebrate the first, but then Anya highlighted some of the statistics where underneath those really high levels, there's still a lot of gaps in the national security community. The study that Anya mentioned from Women in International Security also highlights that about only 30% of top national security positions are made up of or women lead them, and then less than 20% of the active duty military force is women. So in addition to those that are actually in service, there's an important component of the defense community, which is the defense industrial base. And this is where I'm a bit optimistic. So the DIB is the private sector that supports our defense and intelligence community. And we are seeing some very positive trends there that give me hope for women's role in the broader national security sector. For example, women now lead Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and BAE Systems, and they hold many senior positions in other firms, so there's great progress there. Now let me turn a little bit, focus to cybersecurity specifically, which is sort of my bug, and happy to dive into it as much as you have questions about. But this is an area where there's a lot to do, in part because of the challenge around STEM. So cyberspace first, talking about on that, will continue to play an increasingly important role in national security policy. The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, in this year's intelligence threat assessment, highlighted it as the number one threat to the United States. We've seen stories in major newspapers about intrusions into our energy sector and financial institutions from foreign adversaries. And in the defense budget, this is one of the few areas where defense spending is supposed to increase once Congress decides we start spending again. And so in response to the growing concerns over the cyber security threat, the Department of Homeland Security, most recently headed up by a woman, Department of Defense, and the intelligence community are focused on increased hiring for cybersecurity positions. And developing a strong pipeline for these cybersecurity roles will require a greater educational emphasis on science, technology, engineering, and math fields. But unfortunately, there was an article in the New York Times today about this at great length. STEM fields are an area where women remain greatly underrepresented at all educational and professional levels. In 2011, the Department of Commerce put out a study that women represent a mere 24% of the STEM workforce in this country. And the President and First Lady have both highlighted closing this gap as a national priority. So in order to help women break into leadership roles in national security, I believe a big part of that is helping them in cybersecurity and related in STEM fields. And this really gets back to providing more outreach and mentorship early on in STEM programs. And I'm a daughter of a physicist, my mom, so it's near and dear to my heart, and a math major myself. So I'm encouraged, actually. I moved out to the Bay Area about 4 months ago, and through my work at the Chertoff Group, I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of female chief information security officers and chief information officers who are really the leaders in cybersecurity in this area, and it's very encouraging, but I think there's a lot of work to go, particularly related to that. So concluding with the so what, why do we care? And you mentioned on that, mentioned about how this can be translated from the private sector into the roles women can play in the public sector and why you need that balance. There's a story from the movie, I don't know if many of you have seen The Fog of War by Errol Morris. It's a really great film. And of course, this story happened 50 years ago, so there weren't many women in the room. But I think I can translate this story to why it's important to have female voices present in any sort of national security decision-making process. So McNamara, who is the subject of the documentary, describes a situation during the Cuban Missile Crisis where Kennedy and his senior advisors are discussing how to respond to two very different letters from Khrushchev, the outcome of which could potentially lead us down the path toward nuclear war. And during this debate, Tommy Thompson, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union, speaks up with a voice of dissent. And based on his experience, having spent time with Khrushchev and actually living for a time with Khrushchev, he said, Mr. President, I disagree with your view. we can present Khrushchev with an outcome where he can go back to his people and say, Kennedy was going to destroy Cuba and I prevented it. And Thompson eventually proved right. So why does this matter for women? It's because of his experience that made him be the voice of dissent that ultimately led us down the right path. And I think the more different voices and different experiences you have, the better your decision-making process will be. So this applies to the different experiences that women have, the different experiences that men have, the different experiences that people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds have, different experiences from the LGBTQ community have. But the more representation you have, the more experiences you have to make a well-informed decision. And that's why we should encourage women to continue to pursue careers in national security. So that's it for my remarks, and really look forward to your questions.
Thank you for that wonderful remarks and a nice wrap-up, Ms. Webster. Now we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you've been listening to a program called Women in Security, in National Security, with our speakers Anya Manuel and Lauren Webster. Now we're going to have a chance for you to ask questions. Please use the microphone because this is being recorded for podcast. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Hillary, and I work in the area on grants in Department of State grants in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I have a question sort of for both of you, if you don't mind. Have you ever felt limited, especially in the countries that you've worked in before, as a woman in your work and goals?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, it's a really good question, because the excuse, if you will, that you sometimes hear about sending women into certain areas as well, they won't be accepted, and it's a conservative Muslim country, and will people take them seriously? To be frank, I haven't seen that at all. And it's partly because when you go, I've spent time in the Middle East, I do business there, I've spent a lot of time in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and for better or worse, as a Western, well-educated woman, you're such an outlier that in a way it's a huge benefit. Because not only can you talk to the men, because you're a Western woman, so you don't fall into the stigma of the society, but you can talk to the women. So when we go to the Middle East, we'll sometimes meet with not just the political leaders, but the wives of the political leaders. And you'll have this chat over tea that starts very friendly and very casual and very feminine, and everyone's chatting about their children, and very quickly it turns into what people think about other ruling families in the Middle East, and it's a very good intel gathering mechanism. So no, I think it's absolutely not a disadvantage, and in fact it's an advantage. And you see it, and I think actually to the State Department's credit, more and more they're not using that excuse. You know, our DCM in Afghanistan was a DCM is the number two person in an embassy, was in Afghanistan, was a woman for a long time. And you see it more and more. Lots of our ambassadors to Central Asia have been women. So you see that excuse being used less and less.
So my perspective is much more kind of U.S.-centric, but I have a similar sort of experience in that there is still at times a novelty to being a woman in national security in the business world. And it, sometimes it can actually be a benefit, but mainly I look forward to when it's no longer a novelty. So you walk in the room and you're not the only woman, and you're among a more mixed group.
No one else has a question right now.
Oh, okay.
It's actually a follow-on on your comment right now. When I started my career, I was the first woman, the first woman, the first woman, as I'm sure there are other people in this room. So what's your support network? What kind of old girls clubs do you have? And what's the interface between the military and the civilian? Because the old boys club is very tight.
Yeah, no, that's
a great question.
That's a great question.
You want to take this one first?
I'll start and then hand off. But I've looked for a lot of it is kind of you have to go out and build that support network on your own oftentimes and not be shy to approach a woman in a senior position and start developing a relationship. The question is, hey, will you mentor me, but tell me about your experiences. And it's really actually building that relationship. I did a tour, a brief tour, at Cyber Command last year, and there was a phenomenal chief of staff, a one-star in the Navy, who really helped mentor me through that tour. And it's just kind of building those personal relationships that then you start to leverage into kind of the professional network, and it builds on itself.
Mm-hmm. No, that's right. It's a really good question, and two-part answer. One is, there actually is starting to be an old girls network in this world. And B, mentors come in all shapes and sizes. And I think, and I tell my students this at Stanford because I get asked this a lot. I say, if you're the first at something and you wait for a mentor who looks just like you, I mean, if Condoleezza Rice had waited for an African-American woman mentor, she would have waited for a long time, right? Madeleine Albright, same thing. Hillary Clinton, same thing. You know, somebody's got to go first. And I've been lucky enough to have wonderful mentors who are men and who just want to promote people who are good and smart and thoughtful. It's harder because sometimes it really is easier to talk to a woman about the issues that you face. But increasingly, I feel, especially in national security circles, the women's network is very strong. And more so than when I talk to my friends, I'm an ex-lawyer, my friends who are still in law, or my friends who are in the finance industry, where I think it's sometimes a little more harsh. But there is this kind of assumption that senior women in Washington will take your call if you're a woman who's smart and thoughtful and coming up the ranks. I'm not at the top level. I'm sort of somewhere in the middle. But I always make it a point to mentor women and to spend extra time with them. I'll mentor men, too. But what's interesting is that when I was in the State Department, I would have dozens of young men calling me up and saying, can you help me get a job here, basically? One woman. And it's a story I always tell my students or when I give these talks to younger audiences. You've got to put yourself forward, and you've got to actually ask for help. And so occasionally I'll go out and affirmatively seek women that seem really promising but shy. But, man, it's hard to do that, mm-hmm. and we're all busy. And so what I tell people is you got to get out there, and the mentors will appear.
I'll pass the mic in a moment here. In July, we had a speaker, a former Navy SEAL who's still doing some training, Rourke Denver. He's, among a few others, has written a book, A Damn Few, Making the Modern Military. One of the questions asked of him was, how do you feel about possible women SEALs? And he said he had some reservations along the lines of, I like to think of myself as a gentleman. I sure don't act that way with the, they called it the brotherhood and all this. And he said, I really don't have any doubt about the ability of some women to meet their, as you know, very demanding physical requirements. And he said, in picking people, men and women, I'd almost always go for brains over just pure brawn. But that was his reservation, that the esprit de corps, so forth. He said, I'd like to see first maybe how a one group of women SEALs performed as a group of women. So I just wondered what your thoughts are about that reaction.
Mm-hmm. I'll go first on this please. One. I hope we get to a point where men don't say, well, I'll promote the smartest people, whether it's a man or woman, but I'm a little uncomfortable about the concept of women, right? The idea that the but will finally be dropped. But I think women, and it's frankly, we're benefiting from this. It's the generation of women that went ahead of us that did all that hard marching, just like the first Navy SEALs, women Navy SEALs going in are going to have a really, really tough time. But you see more and more, if you push through, there's an acceptance, and it happens pretty quickly. You know, when I was just out of college, I joined an investment bank, an American investment bank in Europe, thinking, well, things have got to be better for women in Europe. It was terrible. We were 5% women, 95% men, a lot of hazing, a lot of what really was sexual harassment, but in Europe didn't count as such. And sort of even just 6 months in, you kind of get this grudging respect, like, oh, well, she didn't quit. Oh, well, she actually is kind of good. And it's painful, and it's not fun. I'm not an investment banker anymore, partly because I don't want to fight that hard fight. But if you have more and more women pushing against that, I think eventually you will pretty quickly find men not saying, well, I'd like to promote a woman, but...
Yeah, I think that the military, for the reputation it gets for being a very slow-moving institution, has actually done a fairly impressive job with integration. So there was a time when nobody could imagine women on carriers. There was a time when nobody could imagine being openly gay in the military, and things get better, and it just surprises people that, yeah, we can actually do this. And there's a great quote in my old college yearbook. I went to Dartmouth. It was, I think, the last Ivy to integrate women. And some old alum comes back and says, you know, in my day there weren't women here. And the woman responds, well, before that, there wasn't electricity. Things get better. And so I think that this can't be a trial by fire. We can't just toss women into the Special Forces community. It has to be a very rigorous plan in how you integrate. But it's surprising that we can actually get through this, and we become a better fighting force for doing it.
Hi, thank you for coming. 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Working with Men, and I traveled to 125 companies and interviewed one woman in each. Wow. This was in the private sector in business. And my question, I'm a psychologist, I worked at Apple and Ernst & Young and a bunch of places. My question for you is, what about women who are over 40 or over 45 who've had an established career in one area, making a career change into national security? And I'm kind of thinking about your comments, Lauren, about the need for different kinds of experiences. Mm-hmm. So these women are facing not just gender discrimination, but age discrimination, and I'm wondering if they have a prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a good question, and I think it's a question that applies beyond national security as well. That is a tough issue. I think, though, in some ways, the way that hiring for national security positions is set up and some of the channels in which you can do that might even be easier than in the private sector. Through what is the job for USA Jobs? Yeah, thank you. And the path through that might be a bit more blind than some of the private sector channels.
And actually, when you talk about the highest level, so when Paul was saying, you know, we've had national security advisors, we have the last, you know, three of the last four secretaries of state, those are all political positions. And so very often, people have alternate careers. Now, they've had a lifelong experience in national security. You hope they have the expertise to actually do the job well. But almost by definition, they've jumped in and out and done either business or been in a think tank or been in academics or been an attorney or been a journalist. So it's actually an unusual career in that you do jump in and out. One last piece. If you're going to do a career from the bottom up, so like a career Foreign Service officer or a career USAID or I think in the military, then it's impossible. These institutions are still quite old-fashioned in their hiring, and I've seen this for men and women, mid-30s, highly educated, very successful in their careers. They come into the Foreign Service and they're stamping visas. Like, what a waste of talent. But that's part of foreign service reform that needs to happen. We're not there yet.
Another question? Well, yes, we have one in the works. Norma, maybe you can follow up, because I have a sort of a follow-up to your, and then we have another one. So, well, anyway, let me ask the question. Since we've been talking about all these positions, secretaries of state and general officers and whatnot, what about the chief job in national security, the commander-in-chief? What is it about the U.S. that we've really haven't had, let me think now, no, none. But if you go around a lot of the world, East Asia, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines twice, Bangladesh twice, India, Sri Lanka, it goes on and on and on, Pakistan. What is it about the U.S.? Why haven't we had a female commander-in-chief? Is this something in our way of looking at the world? Thank you.
Well, for starters, maybe 2016, but but I think it's an interesting question, and I actually gave a talk on this topic on women political representation around the world a few months ago, and really dug into this. And what's interesting is, yes, you've had some elected women leaders, Margaret Thatcher, Angela Merkel. You've had some. But especially the East Asian examples and the South Asian examples you cite, almost all of them, 95% or more, are daughters of, sisters of. It's a family legacy thing more than it is a that people are more feminist and more willing to have female leaders.
Same hope, same concern. You know, there's some interesting studies. We didn't really touch on the why this has been so hard for women to break into national security roles, and this gets to the commander-in-chief question as well. And it's still, I don't know if it's unique to our country, but the way that women are dropping out of the national security workforce right around like early 30s, mid-30s, due to family reasons. And I think until we start to address that more holistically, not just from the national security perspective, but also, you know, private workforce, it's just a question of how big's the pipeline that we're putting up that can eventually get to the top. Mm-hmm.
Let me add one more point on Asia and one on work-life balance. On Asia, what is interesting is that many of the Asian countries have parliamentary quotas, and that makes an enormous difference. So when I was in Delhi at this Women's Leaders Conference, a lot of them were the speakers of the parliament, came in as parliamentarians, and are now running for the highest office in the land. They have, and they're amazing studies that show that having female parliamentarians absolutely changes your government for ways that I would call for the better. More focus on health care, more focus on education, more focus on women and girls, better anti-corruption results. So you really do have a positive governance difference if you have more women in parliament. And, you know, maybe we should consider that here. We're not doing so well in the Congress. On the work-life balance piece, this is absolutely true both in the national security folks that I know and also in law and finance, the other careers I've seen, and I'm sure many of you have seen it too. People come in as a very bright pipeline of fantastic women. And by age 32, 33, 34, you see fewer of them, and you see it across occupations. And it's particularly problematic in the military or in the foreign service where you're expected to be overseas. And for the foreign service, the traditional model was nuclear family, wife travels with husband. When husband is ambassador to wherever, you move every 2 years. The spouse can't get a work permit, much less have a career because you're moving every 2 years to somewhere else. Now, that's becoming more and more of a, not just a women's issue, but an issue for both genders. And I think here you're really seeing a sea change in the generation that's probably sort of 5, 6, 7 years younger than us. One example I'll give is at my former law firm, we had very generous maternity leave and 2 weeks paternity leave. And the women fought to change it and make it equal, 16 weeks full pay for both. And at first the men said, you're crazy, no one will take this. And it's true, the first 2 years, no man took it because there was a stigma associated with taking leave. Now everybody takes it. And so now there's no excuse not to promote women, because what happened is that you would say, well, you can't be promoted to partner this year because, you know, you took that maternity leave. Well, now that's an excuse that's been taken away. And so in the same way, when I hear work-life balance in the government, and you hear this a lot, it sometimes sounds like an excuse for saying, well, women are going to want out because they're going to take care of their children. But I think increasingly, both parents want to be involved in their children's lives. It's just a very different generation. I think my husband's friends, they want to be involved with their kids. They don't want to work all the time. And the national security careers are particularly difficult because, unlike here in Silicon Valley, where you can work hard, but you can work from home and you're always on your iPhone, in Washington, you're in the office. It's all classified. So what you're doing is in the office. And during the time I was in Washington, boy, I'm happy I didn't have any kids then, because I would just not have seen them for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My question was somewhat like Paul's, in that I wonder what you think about how that we compare to other countries. And oh, you mentioned, you know, the statistics or for defense, state, homeland security, that, and maybe not those identical departments, but just in general, your observations. Are there some countries that are doing better than we are in most of the similar areas?
I don't actually know the statistics. I don't know if you do, Lauren, but from anecdotally, when I've interacted with foreign governments, you see a lot of women in Israel, in the national security establishment, also in the military, and nowhere else. That's kind of it. Sorry? France does pretty well. That's a good point. Yeah. I don't know if others have thoughts on this. I just don't know.
Yeah, I don't open up for people who actually know the stats. But it, my impression is that we are certainly lagging for our nearest peers, particularly in the highest rank.
But you're saying we're better than? Or
lagging.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Many Scandinavian countries, they're so good with women's issues in mm-hmm. some other areas.
Yeah.
We have another question.
So back to the work-life balance discussion. Another thing that I think a lot of women encounter is what you were pointing out about the geography and the concentration of jobs around the world. Both of you relocated from Washington, D.C. to here. I just moved back this past weekend.
Welcome. It's nice out here.
Beautiful weather. But it does feel like national security arena is one in which it's very concentrated in D.C. and abroad. I mean, how robust are the opportunities out in California, and how does that work as you move in life and, you know, your husband or your boyfriend needs to relocate somewhere? And how do you make those trade-offs, and especially in this kind of arena?
Yeah, it's tough out here. I mean, at the Chertoff Group, we'll regularly do recruiting, and we hear from people who are interested in working with us how tough it is to find something like what we do we do not contract directly with the government, but even just touches tangentially on that world to kind of scratch the national security itch that I'm sure so many of us in this room have. So it is a very D.C.-centric world, and you just have to look for the pockets out here, whether it's down at Monterey, the Naval Postgraduate School, or some of the small cybersecurity startups that are trying to reach back into D.C., and it's sort of taking a bigger view of what is serving the national security community beyond just a three-letter agency or a military service.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think pockets is exactly the right term. So I get asked this all the time by my Stanford students and other mentees. And there's not a lot, right? There's great academic institutions, but they, both Stanford and Berkeley, approach foreign policy and national security from a very academic perspective. It's not a lot of practitioners who then teach. You have all the foundations, lots of foundations doing good development work. And that's kind of it. And then just as you said, you have some startups that frankly could use help with people, from people who have national security experience. But as Lauren and I find out in our private sector work, there are two worlds that don't intersect very much. Silicon Valley and Washington doesn't really know how to talk to each other, and that's kind of what we do when we're not talking about women's issues.
Yes, I'm curious about a possible linkage or not. If you think about the area of what I would call blue-collar security people, it seems to me there's a lot of advances of recent times of women. Think of in police, in the fire, the Capitol, head of Capitol Police, mm-hmm. and people in these areas, that there's been, as you know, a real barrier to, for example, in many of these, and firefighters is a prime example. But it seems to me that now much more across the country is common to hear the person giving a report on this terrible event or whatever is a woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's any possible linkage or support between women in leadership roles in national security or higher levels and women just across the country in leadership roles in these grassroots, what I would call blue-collar areas.
So a really interesting question, and one that I'm not particularly knowledgeable on. We have a former Secret Service agent over here who might have a bit more information on that. But in some respects, I actually think it may be a bit more difficult for women to break into those blue-collar security jobs, as you called them, because of sort of the culture, the brotherhood, the fraternity, and sort of the stereotypes around who should be in that role and more of the white collar security jobs which look more like an office job and women have been breaking into for the past 50 years. So it's an interesting point and I'm so glad you mentioned the woman who's head of Washington Metro Police, who's really been doing some great things there for both DC and for women in law enforcement.
And I think just like in national security and in the military, it just takes a few leaders to take a real stance. So I'm going to forget the exact positions, but when Gavin Newsom appointed both the chief of police and the fire chief as women, mm-hmm. he got asked lots of questions, and he's like, well, they're the best people for the job. So done. Right? And I think very quickly people get used to women in those roles, and that's the same as now, you know, the military taking a stance on women in combat roles and in diplomacy, people saying, of course, women should be ambassadors. That's not automatically a male job. And it once people are committed to making the change, I think it changes pretty quickly.
We have one here.
We have one here.
Hi, I have really learned so much from you and appreciate all the discussion around percentage of women in these areas. What about, is there any data or science around what we as women bring specifically to this important work?
Yeah.
I'd like to think so.
You know, there probably is, but when I prepped for this talk, I couldn't find it. And so it's all anecdotal because just as I think Lauren said in her opening remarks, the more diversity of viewpoints that you have at the table, the better an outcome you get. And you get it on all fronts and some anecdotal things. Well, Hillary Clinton was the best Secretary of State we've had on women's issues. And she explicitly made it part of most of the speeches that she gave. Mélanie Vervier is a force of nature, and there was always a women's issues kind of office at the State Department, but usually it was a little bit sidelined. This time it wasn't. So those are the really explicit examples, but there are a lot more subtle ones. For example, you know, going back one more, Condoleezza Rice did a lot of work on microfinance, on women in Africa, on anti-corruption things, on promoting women leaders around the world. And she's a more, she wouldn't be as out, she wouldn't be comfortable being as out there publicly as a feminist as Hillary Clinton, but certainly the foreign policy was different because she was a woman and because she was an African-American woman. So you see it. I haven't seen any real studies.
I did the same search, and it is really hard to find that data. I think the data that you pointed to in the private sector, corporate performance is important, and it's just figuring out the right metrics to start doing those measurements. Because how do you say, you know, are we more secure? Is it fewer conflicts? What is the right metric, and then how do you measure that against where women are in the national security field? So I just haven't seen it yet. I would love to see one.
Well, this is part of the problem with foreign policy and national security in general. How do you measure outcomes?
Yeah.
There's not really a bottom line. Can you say, you know, we've averted so many terrorist attacks?
That's a hard,
maybe, but they're all kind of difficult metrics. Yeah.
Just adding on to that, I know... I'm no expert, but I know that in journals that are more psychology-oriented and focused, they have psychological evaluations of women in the intelligence community from, I'm trying to remember, I think it's Richard Hoyer that wrote something about, that had a snippet in his research about how women operate differently and what they put, what they bring to the table in the CIA in this case. But
better spies.
We have time for one last question, and Regina, I think that's you.
No one has one. I was just thinking that maybe women in security have arrived because we have Homeland, a bipolar character, right, who's sneaking drugs and shouldn't have a security clearance, and then we have Covert Affair, Pika Paravu. You know, always breaking the rules at the CIA. You know, I mean, she's not the standard case officer. And then we have a recent book by Valerie Plame, who I guess has written a couple of novels. So does this mean maybe women in security have arrived in a slightly different way?
Cultural phenomenon or a harbinger for what's to come, then that'd be great. There's actually a really great podcast from, I want to say it's the Center for New American Progress, but I'm not sure, that's a three former female CIA officers who worked for the National Clandestine Service talking about the differences between women and men and some of those studies that you mentioned. The psychology studies, and it's an interesting issue. But I think, as we both outlined up front, there's certainly progress being made, and that's the hopeful point, and one that hopefully we'll continue to build on.
Yeah, I hope that the fact that it's acceptable to have women in leadership roles in Hollywood, which sometimes lags behind these things, frankly, in the real life, yeah, things is. You know, a sign of what's to come. But I would hope, and I'll end on a really non-PC point, I would hope that the women in national security don't always have to be attractive and have a drug problem to be interesting.
And 4 foot heels, right?
Exactly.
Well, I'll use my prerogative to make my own non-PC comment. But so we'll know when women have arrived in particularly the spying world if they're parodied. So we have James Bond, never fails. And we have Alec Guinness. Who was Alec Guinness, the character he played?
Smiley.
And we have all these infallible spies. And then we have the Austin Powers and the Get Smarts, the Don Adams, who are idiots, but also always get their man. So as soon as we have females being parodied that same way, then we've arrived. On that rather silly note, our thanks to our two speakers, Anya Manuel and Lauren Webster, for their interesting and informative comments and for the work that they've done and continue to do. Let's give them a little round of applause, please.
Thank you all.
I encourage you to come up and ask them questions face-to-face and take your challenge on promoting yourself. But I also want to thank you, the audience, and I want to thank our volunteers, Norma Walden, who organizes all these events, and Regina Sneed for your help today. I particularly want to thank the sponsors, including Heather Henson of the Women in International Security, WISE, who was, without you, this program would have not come to pass, the Truman National Security Project, the UN Association of Marin, and so this ends this session of the Commonwealth Club of California. Thank you.